I think the point wasn't fair. If you tried to prove it, you'd realize pretty quickly.
Well, you didn't give us like things to prove. You just said state the frequency.
Oh, that one was no. That's true. That's the frequency. Isn't that just the modulation? Yeah.
But we didn't know like the name of what that was.
All right. Yeah.
And then like one was like signal to noise ratio of some power, but we didn't know that you had to square the signal like divided by something to do that.
Well, we have talked about parts. I knew you were gonna have a little bit of trouble on that one because we haven't. This textbook doesn't talk a lot about power and energy signals, but we have talked about those.
And then like show this in Bode plots, like.
Except I think actually we can't do a Bode plot because it was unstable.
Like but I don't really know what a Bode plot is.
Yeah, that was.
So like half the problems we could not do out of the gate, like.
All right, well.
I'll sorry.
I'll focus on the things you should have known how to do.
Okay,
let's go ahead.
That'll be beneficial or not.
I spent a lot of time making good answers for that.
But unfortunately, your scores on the things you didn't know how to do are probably tied to your scores on the show.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I'm like, I don't know. Just.
Okay, let's go ahead.
Figure out whatever you can do to give me the best grade possible.
Right, I'll take the sum of all the parts and divide by the total by, instead of out of 100 out of 50.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk today about stability. Finally, we're going to formally talk about stability, and we'll then use an RC circuit as an example, and then we'll show you a nice little kind of trick, a nice little algorithm for determining stability of a polynomial, and then we'll talk about the step response of first-order systems. And we'll work mostly in the Laplace domain today.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, we're getting down to the end of the semester. I know it doesn't, for me it's going pretty fast, but I'm sure for you guys it's like you can't happen soon enough. But we'll have an exam. The final exam, I think, is scheduled for like the end of the fourth, the end of the third, the last class or something like that. So we need to start preparing for that. Another week or so, and we're going to go through a lot of material between now and then, but we won't go through it in as much depth because we're now sort of into the applications portion of the course. So each lecture we'll be talking about different kinds of techniques and different tools. So we're going to cover a lot of material, a lot of new concepts, basically. So stability of continuous time systems in the S-plane. Recall our stability condition for the Laplace transform. What is required for a system to be stable? If I give you a system, let's say I give you a differential equation, and I ask you, is this system stable? How would you go about answering that question?
Value as the system approaches infinity.
What?
Like value as time approaches infinity. If it goes to infinity, it's unstable.
Okay, but how can we? That would certainly be one way. That would require doing a time domain solution of the differential equation.
I look at the poles and check out where the poles lie.
Okay, well, where do the poles come from?
From the Laplace transform.
Of the signal. Differential equation, right?
Yeah.
So you take the differential equation, you do what?
You integrate it.
No.
From
take
negative
transform.
Infinity to
fine, take the Laplace transform.
Z and negative ST.
Okay, right.
Take the limit. Because you can't do that.
You take the differential equation.
You do an integral from negative infinity.
You find the Laplace transform. And then what?
Well,
how do you get the transfer function?
The transfer function? Oh, you're
going
to have to divide the output by the input.
Y of S over. So you find Y of S over X of S. And then what?
And then you can look at the like region of convergence for it. And if the region of convergence is in the positive, like real area of the
okay, well this would be a causal system, so region of convergence will take care of itself.
Oh, okay.
So we're gonna look at the poles.
Look at the poles. Where does the poles of what? The poles of the transfer function, which come from binding the
zeros of the denominator.
Very good. And then finally, the poles of the transfer function must be where?
Left half plane.
Why?
In the right half plane, you've got terms that are e to the positive.
thing.
Excellent, very good. So each one of these poles sort of translates to an e to the alpha t component of the output response. So if any of those poles are in the right half plane, you're going to have e to the positive alpha t, which is going to grow. So that's a problem. So that kind of thought process that we just went through, this is what seems to be missing on the exams. I actually think many of you could go through that if you didn't panic on these exams. Because I think many of you know that, you know, the steps, you're just not articulating them well in your exam solutions. And the articulating those steps is much more important to me than writing down the answer that you have copied on your impressive reduction of all the homework solutions into 1 8.5 by 11 page. So we have our transfer function. And if we want the system to be stable, the poles have to be in the left half plane. If we took what that amounts to with the impulse response is that the impulse response must go to zero as t goes to infinity. That's not a necessary, that's not a sufficient condition for stability, but it's a necessary condition. The formal necessary and sufficient condition is that the integral of the absolute value of h of t is less than infinity. A system is said to be marginally stable if its impulse response is bounded, which means that the magnitude of h of t is less than or equal to c. This means that at least one pole of the system lies on the j omega axis. So, if I give you a black box and I tell you that that box is marginally stable, how could you determine that? How could you prove that to me?
See if there's a pole in the Fourier transform?
No. I give you a black box.
Yeah, what do you mean you give us a black box?
I give you this thing. Except I scratch off all the writing on it. And I say it's got a line level input somewhere here. And a line level output.
Okay, well then you can do the transfer function as input and output.
No. And I ask you, is that box marginally stable?
Does it blow up? Is it real? Does it exist? Like,
so what would you do? I give you a box. I tell you what the electrical specifications of the input and the output are in terms of voltage, impedance, whatnot, so that you can connect the signal generator to it. And I ask you, is that box marginally stable? How would you test that?
See what happens with DC input?
Close, not DC.
But just AC?
Actually, yes, you could do it with DC. What you'd actually do is you would apply the step, a unit step function.
Correct.
And what would you expect to happen when you apply the unit step function? If the system is stable, what would you expect to happen?
You'd get a
decaying.
You'd get a DC out or zero DC.
You'd get DC out because the impulse response is the derivative of the step response, right? So if you apply, what I was looking for is that you would apply an impulse. And what you would expect to see, if the system is stable, you would expect the impulse response to go to zero. If the system is marginally stable, what would you see in the output?
It'd be something goofy because there's a pole with the f of zero.
Could you define, we can be a little more specific than goofy.
It should probably grow.
No.
It's going to be stable.
So if it's marginally stable, what's going to happen is the system's going to oscillate.
Oh.
Most likely the system will oscillate. You can create some examples where it's the sum of sine waves that don't have the right periods and things. But generally speaking, if the system's marginally stable, it's going to oscillate. And you've probably seen this in the lab when you're playing around with circuits with feedback or things, and if you don't get them quite right, they explode. If you don't get them, they're too damped, or at some point they kind of just oscillate a bit. So periodic signals have poles on the j omega axis and therefore are marginally stable. So if the system is marginally stable, it's going to have a pole on the j omega axis, which translates down to an output, which is a sine wave or periodic signal. Also recall that the left half plane maps to the inside of the unit circle in the z-plane for discrete time signals, so all of that we've said for Laplace transforms, we can say for Z transforms, except in the case of Z transforms, the poles have to be inside the unit circle. Now, one of the things that we'll do today is we can show that circuits built from passive components, RLCs, for example, are always stable if there is some resistance in the circuit. And that's just sort of the basic laws of physics. And if there's no resistance, which can't happen in the real world, they can be, they can oscillate. And you've all experienced that when you try to build really sharp bandpass filters with L's and C's, and you found that they have these impulse responses which tend to oscillate. Right? Dr. Wynn's famous bandpass filters.
Mm-hmm. Not all of us get to take Dr.
Wynn. We used to have a lab, he had designed years ago in the curriculum, a nice little lab where you really had to tune all the little components and get them just right for the circuit to achieve its bandpass characteristic. Otherwise, it wasn't even close. So the students would build this thing, and then they'd sit in the lab for hours trying to figure out why it wouldn't work. And the reason was that the 10% type components or 5% tolerance components, you just couldn't get it tuned up properly. So then if you put some potentiometers in the circuit or something, you could tune it to get it just right to where it would act like a bandpass filter. So let's look at an example of this with an RLC circuit. So here we have our old friend, a series RLC circuit. And we have written the transfer function for this. H of S is 1 over LC divided by S squared plus R over L times S plus 1 over LC. We get that just by writing a Kirchhoff's voltage law, writing a loop equation, and then you know, transferring, you can do that in the Laplace domain, or you can write the differential equation, and you can then take Laplace transform. We've done that a number of different ways, but why is that, when you look at that circuit, and you say, well, the transfer function is a second order polynomial, what's your sanity check on that?
Is
if I wrote a third order polynomial there, I would hope somebody at some point would say,
you don't have a component that integrates things like twice or differentiates things twice.
You've only got two active components.
Well, you have no active components. You're close, though.
I mean, reactive components.
Right. So you've got an inductor and a capacitor. Each one of those translates to a derivative. So when you're going to write this thing as a Laplace transform, you're going to get two derivatives. So it should be a second order polynomial. If there was a third inductor in the circuit, in let's say we put a parallel inductor or something, you would expect a third order differential equation. So taking this transfer function and using the world's most useful equation, the quadratic equation, we can write the roots of that polynomial. We can write minus the R over L, minus R over 2L plus or minus the square root of R over 2L squared minus 1 over LC.
Is it 1 over LC or 1 over RC? Because I seem to remember an example in the book where they did this. And
It's 1 over LC.
Okay.
Because it's the quadratic equation is the middle term squared minus 4 times the...
I mean the transfer function H of F.
Yeah, it's one over LC on the far end. You mean on the denominator?
In the numerator and in the left right hand term on the denominator.
Yeah, it's one over. It should be 1/LC.
Okay.
Okay, so the behavior of the circuit is going to depend to some extent on the values of R, L, and C. So let's look at a few cases. Let's look at, as a first case, let's look at the case when this term is greater than zero. Now, when this term is greater than zero, what can we say about the poles?
Which term is greater than zero?
The term under the
determinant?
The determinant, right.
Then,
so if this is positive,
they have real poles.
We have essentially two real poles, right? So if the poles are real, then the system is always going to be stable, because we can actually look at the locations of the poles. So if this term is positive, we have a term here plus the square root of, now this term is this term squared, but we're subtracting a little bit from it. So this square root term is always going to be smaller than this term, which means the combination of the two is always going to be less than zero, which means the poles will be in the left half plane, and therefore the circuit is always stable. Okay, does everyone follow that? And that's there's no surprise to that. We'll explain why in a moment. But let's look now for a case where this term is less than zero. When this term is less than zero, we have the square root of a negative number, which gives us what? Which gives us?
Complex conjugate root.
Complex conjugate root. Very good. We have, this will be the square root of a negative number, so we'll have some number plus and minus j times some number. But since that polynomial has all positive coefficients, all real coefficients, we have to have complex conjugate poles. So we have two complex conjugate poles, and the real part of those poles is going to be minus the ratio of two numbers, which are real positive numbers. So this is always going to be negative, which means that the poles of that system are in the left half plane and it has to be stable. And then the third case, in this case we have, I kind of should have explained this better. So we have plus or minus the square root. So in the case with where we have this constant minus something and this constant plus, the same is basically true that the net combination of those things will be negative, because, as I explained, this number is always going to be less than this number of magnitude. So in either case, no matter what the values of R, L, and C are, this circuit is stable and the poles are in the left half plane. So the RLC circuit is always stable. Now the question for the physicist in the room is why? If I remove the resistance, it's marginally stable, which is pretty close.
Yeah, because
why is it not unstable?
Because there's nothing adding power to the system.
Right. It's essentially a passive circuit. So it's not surprising that system will be stable. And in fact, most physical systems by themselves, if you think about that this table as a mechanical system, it's going to be stable. Now, why do bridges collapse?
Metal fatigue. That energy is put into them.
They collapse because there's additional inputs that cause them to resonate. Or, as we talked about with the Tacoma-Narrows bridge, it resonates properly. And that resonating structure exceeds the mechanical properties or strengths of that structure, so they fail. So you can't have a system like a bridge that will crash, but that requires, as was mentioned earlier, some kind of energy input to make that happen. The system by itself is not going to suddenly start oscillating. So just similarly, this RLC circuit will always be stable. But that doesn't mean that for certain inputs that resonate with the circuit, you can't get a very large output. And that's essentially what a bandpass filter is. You can tune that circuit so that for certain frequencies, you can get much larger output than for other frequencies. And that's when the frequency of your input resonates with the values of the inductor and capacitor, so that they're basically passing energy back and forth.
Will you ever get an output that's larger than your input for that circuit?
No, that's a good question. Can you get amplification out of the circuit? And these kinds of questions I know sometimes you think these are sort of idle classroom discussion, but I think these are really important things to understand because it ultimately relates to the basic physics of the problem. So can you get amplification out of that circuit?
I mean, with resonance, couldn't you? At a resonant frequency, would it not amplify?
So if you put a one volt sine wave in, could you get a sine wave out that has a amplitude greater than 1 volt?
Best you could do is resonant frequency give you 1 volt.
How many people think you could design that circuit to get a sine wave greater than 1 volt in amplitude? How many people are willing to bet on their answer to that question? So I think I'm seeing enough stares of concern that I will award ten extra credit points on an exam, another 10 points.
Hey.
If you can produce for me an explanation of that circuit. You can do it through MATLAB, you can do it, any of the tools available to you other than Dr. Winton. Because I might not understand the explanation Dr. Winton gives me. Prove to me whether you can get amplification out of that circuit. Or that whether or not you can. Okay, and I'd like that solution by, let's say, when next Wednesday morning, when the class next Wednesday, so you've got a little bit more time.
Does PSPICE work?
Any tool at your disposal. But think about it. It's a passive circuit. Think about what amplification involves. Think about the difference between circuits with op amps and semiconductors versus circuits with passive components. And if you can write a nice little one-page explanation of all that, I think that would be a good exercise. As you probably figured out, ultimately as engineers, you're going to be paid for your instincts, not your ability to solve really detailed questions. So these kinds of questions we ask in class, these are the kinds of questions you'll actually face on the job. Can you do such and such? Not sort of all the details. So that's why these instincts become important. And sometimes I think we lose that when we're, beating you with all these details of solving homework problems and things like that. But hopefully that's built, you use all that knowledge and that turns into instinct at some point. So how can we determine if a system is stable? Well, in the olden days when we didn't have all these high-powered computing facilities, we had these cute little algorithms like the Ruth Hurwitz stability test. We used to spend a lot of time on things like this because it was very hard to factor a polynomial, find out where the poles were, and then check the locations of the poles. In fact, in MATLAB, it still is, if you want to factor like a 128th order polynomial, you still may have some problems. Because numerically, that's a tough thing to do. There's a lot of numerical issues in that. So the Ruth Hurwitz stability test is a nice, interesting algorithm that tells us something about stability. And it's actually fairly easy to implement in code, and it doesn't have the kinds of numerical problems that equation solvers have, root finders have. And it's based on properties of polynomials, so it involves some really nice theoretical math, you could say. So the procedures, the stability test is a method for determining stability using simple algebraic operations on the polynomial coefficients. It's best demonstrated through an example. So let's look at the case of a polynomial A of S. Assume this is a polynomial in the denominator of a transfer function. And the question we want to ask is, can I look at this polynomial and determine if the system is stable? So the first thing we do with this process is we construct what's called the Routh array. We take every other coefficient and we write it along the first row of the Routh array. We then take the alternating coefficients, the ones we missed, and write them along the second row. So we have these first two rows
that represent every other coefficient. Now the next thing that we do is we start calculating the remaining terms in this array. And the way we do that is we actually calculate what's sort of like a pseudo-determinant calculation. We take the, for example, if you look at this bn minus 4 term here, we take these two terms, multiply them together, minus these two terms, and we divide that by the term in the first column. And we form then this this term here. So for this term, so we go through this array and we essentially do that by calculating these terms which represent these determinants. And the general form of that equation is shown here. So for bn minus 2, we take an minus 1 minus an times an minus 2 minus this product divided by an minus 1. And then for bn minus 4, we take these two minus these two. And for bn minus 6, we march down the array that way. And then we just repeat that for the subsequent rows until we've filled out this array. And we'll the number of rows is related to the order of polynomial. And then it turns out with a fair amount of math, theoretical math, you can show that the number of sign changes in the first column are equal to the number of poles in the right half plane. And I don't know why that's there. That's a typo. So then all you do is you look down the column here and you count the number of sign changes, the number of times it alternates from negative to positive or positive to negative. So let's work an example where we do that. So here we have a polynomial s squared plus a1s plus a0. We go ahead and construct the route array. So the first row is the coefficient corresponding to s squared, which is 1, and then the coefficient corresponding to the you take every other term, so a0. The second row then becomes a1, and since there's no other terms, we put a 0 in the column for that. And then the third row is going to be a1 times a0 minus 1 times 0, which is a1, which is just 0, divided by a1, and that just gives us a0. And then the second term in that row is also 0 because there's no more coefficients. So we see that for this second order polynomial, if a1 is greater than 0 and a0 is less than 0, we're going to have one sign change, because when we go from 1 to a1, there won't be a sign change, but when we go from a1 to a0, there will be one sign change. If a1 is less than 0 and a0 is less than 0, then we still have one sign change because we start with a positive value 1, then we go to a negative value a1, and then we go to a negative value a0. And then if a1 is less than 0 and a0 is greater than 0, then we have actually two sign changes, so there must be two right half plane poles. So that's an example of how we apply the Routh array to a second order polynomial. Now we can do a third order example just to make this a little more concrete. So for a third order polynomial, we take one, we take a1 and put it here. Since it's a third order polynomial, we don't have any additional coefficients. So then for this second row, we're going to have a2 and we're going to have a0. And then for the third row, we're going to compute a2 times a1 minus 1 times a0 divided by a2. So that gives us a1 minus a0 over a2. And then for the second term, we'll again have zero because we're out of terms. And then for the S0 term, we're going to have this we're going to have this term times this term minus zero times this term divided by this term. And if you work through the simplification of that, it actually turns out to simplify to A0. So for this third order polynomial, if depending on the values of A0, A1, and A2, we'll have certain conditions. If A2 is less than 0 and A0 is greater than 0, we're going to have two sign changes. So if A2 is less than 0, we have a sign change here, and if A0 is greater than 0, we'll have an additional sign change. So we'll have two sign changes and two right half poles, which means the system is unstable. So this is a fairly simple way to determine the number of poles. You don't get the exact pole locations, but at least you can determine the number of poles in the right half plane.
Can you explain how you got the A0 for S0 again?
That's if you just go through the simplifications, it's still this times this minus this times this.
Right.
Divided by this.
All right.
And if you simplify it, it'll work out to A0. Though it's not obvious from the things there. Now, another nice thing about this is, of course, MATLAB has a function that does this. So you can actually call that function and get to see the whole shot displayed. So you can work a couple examples by hand, and then you can look at what MATLAB does and make sure that everything correlates. So this kind of thing was popular, like I said, in the days when computing wasn't so prevalent, and people did a lot more design by hand. But these days, it's with all the tools we have, where you can look at poles and zeros and manipulate them graphically and all that kind of stuff, it's not as significant.
Dr. Bacconi, so you said, like, if we've got a system with 128 poles, we'd still need to do that because MATLAB can't handle a polynomial that big.
Right.
What kind of system would be that big?
Oh, a digital filter. We build digital filters that have thousands of coefficients.
Okay.
Audio filters in some of your high-end audio equipment will have 128 coefficients.
Do each of those correspond to a discrete component, or?
Well, on the digital filter side, it's software. It's,
okay.
But with analog filters, you know, I guess it's a good question these days, is what are the longest analog filters being used these days? I know that in some consumer equipment like CD players and things like that, they use maybe seventh order discrete filters for the AD converters and things sometimes. And some like really inexpensive consumer toys, you may see fifth order, seventh order analog filters, but you don't see too many analog filters anymore. If you do, they're usually implemented in some kind of module where the components are precision tuned. You don't see discrete components. I don't know. Our guys from PV aren't here right now. They could probably tell us. I'm sure PV has some analog equipment that maybe uses a bigger filter, but.
Do they ever use analog ICs for that kind of work, or?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what I'm saying. I think you will find from time to time some analog filters implemented in an IC-type package, where they've actually precision cut the resistors and capacitors. But so much of this stuff now is, if you're going to do a bigger filter now, most likely it's going to be digital. Though, if you're going to do the analog filter design today, well, a lot of the analog filters that are used are very low-order filters, first, second, third-order filters that are built with really inexpensive electronics, or electronics that has to operate at very, very high speeds. Like the gigahertz. If you're doing something in the gigahertz range, you don't want to do too much of that digitally because your processor is just not fast enough. Now, but one of the reasons, again, sort of something we've been talking about throughout the semester, one of the reasons a lot of this analysis is still relevant is a lot of mechanical systems are still described by these low-order differential equations where you need to understand the properties. So, if you look at...
modern plumbing?
Modern plumbing? Yeah. Well, I was thinking of actually the Discovery Channel. I was watching a show the other night where they were talking about the how metal fatigues over time and how that affects... I love these Build It Bigger shows and all this kind of stuff where they talk about all this really cool construction stuff. And, you know, usually they get into... when they start having problems with these structures, it's because a particular member is being stressed more than it should have been and that kind of thing. And sometimes they get into these really subtle situations where the physical properties of a part, like the metal that they used when it was forged or the purity of the metals that were used when it was when that metal was fabricated, play a role in the fatiguing of that product. And then you'll see that the models of this kind of stuff are often very low-order things like first and second-order systems because they're just talking about, they just need an approximation for how this system behaves over time. They don't need a really detailed system. And when you talk about things like motion detectors, cruise controls, those are all essentially very low-order differential equations. So, and we've talked a little bit about race cars. A lot of the damping that's done on race cars, it can be modeled as first and second order type differential equations. It's very simple, but it's all tunable. So let's talk a little bit about what we're going to do today, and then we'll finish this next class, is talk a little bit about the general nature of the response of a first and second order system. So first, let's talk about the analysis of a step response for a first order system. So recall the transfer function for a first-order differential equation. It's just h of s is equal to k over s minus p. And if we look at the step response to this system, well, the Laplace transform of the unit step function is 1 over s. So we can write that all first-order systems, the step response is essentially can be y of s is equal to k over s times s minus p. And then we can factor that with partial fractions expansion, and we can write that that's minus k over p divided by s plus k over p times s minus p, just separating this out into 1 over s plus 1 over s minus p and solving for the residues. And we know now that if I take the inverse Laplace transform of this equation, I get essentially minus k over p. This term maps to a u of t response. This term maps to a exponential. So the combined response is just minus k over p times a quantity 1 minus e to the minus pt times u of t. So this is in general, this is a general solution to all first order differential equations, whether this is plumbing as we talked about or mechanical structures or electric circuits. So we can define a time constant as the time it takes for the response to reach 1 over e or 37% of its value. When we talk about the time constant, that's what we talk about. And in this case, the value of that time constant is 1 minus 1 over p. You've seen that kind of a thing before in your circuits classes. Now, the connection that I want to make now, though, is that the real part of the pole is p, and this means that the real part of the pole, which is the distance of the pole from the J omega axis, is directly related to the time constant. So when we talk about this, the pole location, of this circuit, where does the pole have to lie for this system? This is a first order differential equation. The values are real numbers. So it has to lie on the real axis. If the pole is over here, this means that p is greater than zero. This means that in that case it means p is less than zero. If the pole is over here, it means p is greater than zero. This is stable. This is
is unstable. So when the pole is in the left half plane, when P is I thought I had that backwards. So when this P is negative, this thing, we get this exponential decay. So the step response to the system when P is negative looks like this. It's going to essentially start at zero and then rise to its steady state or end value of one, because when P is negative and T becomes large, this term goes to zero and we're just left with one there. So all first order systems essentially have this step, this kind of the step response is of this shape. And the only thing that really differentiates them is the amount of time that it takes for this curve to reach 37% of its final value. That's what we call the time constant. So there's one parameter associated with this curve, which is related to the pole of the system. So first order systems are fairly simple in terms of their simple to analyze in terms of their pole location, and the distance of that pole from the J omega axis is what determines essentially the time constant for that response. Now that's an important observation, because we can generalize that to higher order systems. If I have a complex conjugate pair of poles, what kind of a response am I going to see from this system? So if this is the S plane, and I have these complex conjugate poles, what is the transfer function of this system going to look like? If the system consists of these two poles,
is it going to be something like plus J, like S plus J blah over S minus J blah or something?
Right. Which, so if I multiply those two together, I'm going to get what kind of a polynomial?
You get the conjugate, complex conjugate, or
you get a second order polynomial.
I'm going to get a second order polynomial, right? I'm going to get something like that. And these are going to be real numbers, because we have these complex conjugate poles. Now, when I ask you, well, what does the impulse response of this circuit look like?
It oscillates above and below the axis.
Well, we're going to expect some kind of something like that. Now, what is going to control the rate at which this decays?
It's going to be RC, right?
So what in terms of the pole locations is going to control the rate at which that decays?
Distance from the real?
Distance from the imaginary axis.
So it's the real component? Yep.
This distance. So this is from the first order differential equation, we learn a very important property about all polynomials, or all systems that can be described by these polynomials, which is that the location, the distance of these poles from the J omega axis is going to determine how quickly the system response decays. Now, when you're building digital filters, when you're building filters in general, you'll be dealing with lots of different poles. But one of the things that becomes important, essentially, is their distance from the geomag axis, because that tells you how quickly they decay. And actually, the pole that's closest to the geomag axis will have a lot to do with the overall response of the system.
What would the response of a system like that look like? Can you just dive on that, or
this system?
Yeah. It'll just have a different envelope.
It'll have like another response imposed upon it, right?
Yeah, I mean it'll essentially just look something like that.
Cool.
Okay, because it's a sum of, because there's additional frequency components, not just an additional.
Right. You can think about this as the sum of three complex conjugate pairs. You've got three complex conjugate pairs, so that's three damped sine waves. So what are all the different ways you could sum three damped sine waves with different amplitudes? Well, there's only so many types of shapes you can get out of that.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense.
Now that's the neat thing. You know, I think this is really one of the neat things about engineering, about math, is that so the only thing that just by changing the shape of this impulse response, you get all sorts of different functionalities out of the circuit. For example, if you want the system to have linear phase, then you're going to have to arrange. It turns out if you want the system to have linear phase, the impulse response is going to look, it's going to have this symmetry about the time delay. If you want the system to be a low-pass filter, it's going to have this kind of damped response. If you want the system to be a bandpass filter, it's going to typically have this kind of oscillatory response. So just by changing these, the pole locations, changing the coefficients of this function, you can achieve a lot of different types of systems. And that's essentially what circuit design is all about. You're given some specification for the circuit in terms of either time domain properties or frequency domain properties, and then your job is to design a circuit with as few components as possible that meets the requirements of your customer or the specification. I think that was the MATLAB code, right? You can see the MATLAB code is really complicated for this. But you can do step responses in MATLAB using the step function. So what we've done today is to review stability of a CT system in terms of the location of the poles in the S-plane. We've demonstrated that an RLC circuit is unconditionally stable. You have a little homework assignment. Jan's got some credit on that. We've introduced the Ruth-Hurwitz technique for determining stability of a system, and the main benefit of that approach is that it does not require finding the roots of a polynomial. We've analyzed the properties of the impulse response and the step response of a first-order differential equation. And what we'll do next time is actually continue on this discussion about what second-order systems need to look like. The impulse responses of first and second order systems, I cannot emphasize how much you will see this throughout your lifetime. And this is, I'm talking about whether you're talking about how your children behave, or whether you're talking about how what happens when you hit that wall with a hammer or something. I mean, it's a properties that have many, many different kinds of applications. If you've ever wondered when two cars smash into each other, when they bounce off each other, why they behave that way, it all can be described in these kinds of with these kinds of equations. And therefore, the trade-offs of, for example, the fast rise time, the slow decay, you'll see that many, many engineering problems, all that really differentiate them is the way someone has set up the particular response times. But there's fundamentally nothing different about those two problems. And that's particularly true with a lot of products. You look at a lot of products sometimes and you wonder, well, what differentiates one company's product from another company's product? And often it's just simply how they've tuned the parameters of the model
products are basically the same in terms of complexity. Okay, I will see you on whenever Monday is. Today is Friday.
Today is Friday. Well, it's just another manic Monday. Nice surprise that Monday turned into Friday. Every day is Monday.
So the input is assigned a 1-volt time.
You're
free to choose whatever values are around.
You're not.
The question is, what is the maximum amplitude of the
outer?
We're in a hurry. It's supposed to start at 12.
What?
It's supposed to start at 12.
Yeah, but I mean,
any frequency
is like 3 hours.
Yeah, but they get like.
I'll talk to y'all and tell you stuff at 12.
Do
what? That's 1 till 11. They talk to you at 12 and then you get to.
I'm not sure how long they're going to be there today, but I thought on the phone he said anytime from 8:30 to 5:30 they're doing stuff. I think there's an award ceremony too.
Okay. Well, because like I was thinking of trying to help out like after Harmonix left and our other stuff he told me. I don't know. I mean, like I don't know if it'd be worth it for me to go over there like 3:30 or just try to find something else.
I mean, Hayner is riding over there. I guess.
Yeah.
I can give you the person's phone number if you want to call him. So like, hey, what's going on? Can I suck him up for you?
Yeah. Okay.
You want to send them? Aaron Heisel, he's the director of something or other in the college.
Mom doesn't send them. She doesn't. It's just a way to demonstrate
that. When did I send out the email? I'm going to give you the wrong one. I'm going to look it up
online. That's really strange.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. As long as you're not violating, as long as you're not.
How long have you had this?
He's had it for about
anywhere a week and a half.
Okay,
that's cool.
That's what I thought.
How do you like it?
I like it a lot so far.
How long have you had this? That's
a year and a half.
Yeah,
so after using this for not very long, it makes my 15 inches huge. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I love it.
I'm considering getting an ultra mobile at some point. I'm not sure which one I would
talking
get.
About.
Probably that one. Just
yeah.
The Epic, right, yeah.
662-648-9951.
Oh, man.
You can just call her and be like, I'm trying to see if there's still stuff going on at the science fair, how long do y'all have stuff going on. I forgot about that meeting at 3, I just told someone I can meet them at 3, I guess I need to tell them I'm not.
Yeah, I had completely forgotten about it until someone mentioned it last night.
I remember like when I saw Dr. Jones, and I was like, hey, I'll see you at 3.
Awesome.
But then I forgot just a minute.
Obviously, there were a number of people who were just writing down things. What I would do is cross their whole exam. Because that has situations where someone
goes
back. Yeah, I just want to ask him when he's going to get our grades back.
Yeah, I was kind of wondering about that.
I was just trying to figure out. So by the time I got here,
I definitely pulled out some of the stuff we went over today when I answered.
Yeah, I didn't. I talked about everything in the right fashion. I just didn't do anything right. That's the problem. Because, like,
I guess I said, like, there are poles in the left hand, but there's a pole in the right hand.
I didn't get a pole in the left hand.
Maybe on the right half.
One on the left and one on the right. First thing.
Well, I don't know.
They're ridiculous.
Mine didn't work out well.
Yeah. It was kind of a hard one.
No worries.
I mean, I know I had a feedback loop. A double feedback loop.
Things are kind of measly. We now really, we had some that were really intense last semester control systems. Definitely in an unfair advantage for this.
That's an aerospace class?
Yeah.
Hey, Dr. Picani?
Yeah.
When do you think you'll have our exam?
This weekend? Yeah.
Alright, thanks. Cool. Thank you.
getting to all the homework problems.